listening to Beside Stillwater's Netcast, a tabernacle service of Stillwater's home churches and worship center.
Do you think that's the point? I mean, we're part of a great undertaking that God did. From the beginning, and we don't know how long that's been, but God's been around forever, and people have been loved by Him, and somewhere along the line, we've gotten off track as human beings, and so God's on this grand mission. He's seeking out the human race, and he's revealing himself, and he's prodding, and he's poking, and he's doing things to reveal who he is, to reconcile. And as we begin to look at those things and understand what that actually looks like. I mean, when we arrive at we might start off with certain ideas of who God is, and in our infancy, so to speak, we have maybe idealistic views, maybe, you know, and maybe there's a purity in the innocence of not knowing much, you know, that maybe that's even closer to God than as we educate ourselves. But slowly, what we do is we become Christianized and we become standardized. And is that's kind of what my question is. Is that the point? To make us all think the same things and do the same things. Last week we talked about we all want to make sure that we're okay. We all want to make sure that we're not too far off of the fray. You know, that we're normal. And we found out in David's life, and we found out in the apostles' life, and we found out even what Paul's saying to the Ephesian church in last week's readings. We found out that they are being formed by everyone around them, not necessarily formed by God. You know, we talked about even Herod. You know, he was not free. He wasn't free to act on his own behalf. He was afraid of his dinner guests. He was afraid of his wife. He was afraid of the political machine. He needed to acquiesce to Rome. I mean, there were all these things that made him dance. And this week is really no different. Except that this week maybe we're focusing in maybe a little closer on the idea that in the pursuit to be normal, in the pursuit to be accepted and liked by God, that everything else forms us and this standardized sort of Christianity emerges. And we're not part if somehow we don't do it like everybody else. Last week we talked about David dancing, and he was, the smartest thing he did was not steal God's thunder, you know, by making himself the jester. It's a way of becoming humble in God's presence, allowing God to have the spotlight instead of himself. But this week, you know, we're past that. And David is king this week. And David's, in a way, trying to be humble. In a way, he's trying to do the normal things, you know, that a king would do and show his power and strength that way. And in a way, he's trying to walk the edge of that and also somehow be pleasing to God because he really doesn't want to piss God off. So He's strolling around and he notices that he's living high on the hog. And he thinks that God is mad that David's living better than he is, if that's possible. But do you see the arrogance in that? The thing that never occurred to David is maybe he shouldn't live in such opulence. Maybe he should have kept doing that dance. Maybe he should have lived below, what Michael wanted him to be as a king. I mean, after all, we do have a version of a king doing it the right way in Jesus, of course. But it never occurs to David that maybe I have too much stuff. Maybe I'm too much of all that. Maybe I'm too full of myself. So his idea is the same as every other nation's idea. Let me build a really, really big temple because I have a really, really big God. And if I make this really, really big temple, then all those pitiful gods out there that are in charge of the other nations will be afraid at the size of ours. And he sets off on conquest. And does that represent God? There was this disturbing thing that I ran across in the Huffington Post today, this morning. And it was, I can't remember all three of them, but one was YWAM, one was Campus Crusade for Christ, and there was another one in there. And they have a plan for taking over the nation, and in fact, taking over the world for Christ. And believe it or not, the plan involves seven mountains. And on those seven mountains, they need to infiltrate those seven mountains in their mountains of politics, mountains of media, mountains of, there were a bunch of things like that. And what they were, they represented all the things of the world. And so their idea was that they were going to infiltrate that with Christians. And they begin in Washington because they own a house in Washington. And some of the Republican representatives live in that house practically rent-free when they're in Washington and attend Bible studies there. And what they've done is they've zoned this place as a church. Does that sound familiar to you? So they're living in a church. And it just so happens that three of the prominent people that live there are the three of the ones that gave way to sexual immorality and cheated on their wives and went to France and did a whole bunch of other things. These are the guys that have infiltrated our government, so to speak, in order to Christianize or to turn the country back to Christianity. Now, we've been talking about myths, and we've been talking about myths of biblical proportion, and here we have one that somehow we were founded as the United States on Christian principles, and that is patently not true. We had talked in weeks past about idolatry. And last week alone, we talked about serving other gods. And in most of these churches, you'll walk in and you'll find an American flag. You'll have people that have no problem with swearing allegiance to an earthly government. Those are things that the early church fought against. They're things that Jesus did not institute. The fact that he calls himself a king is sort of a tongue-in-cheek expression. It's sort of like, you've seen kings. Well, I got a king for you. I'll show you a king. And he's sort of like how Superman had Bizarro Superman. Well, this is kind of, Jesus is like Bizarro King. The complete opposite, but it's the only thing that they really understand. And so he goes breaking all the rules and all the molds of what earthly kings are. What they plan to do in Washington is take over the country with power. Take over the country by controlling all these things. And Jesus comes along as our true king. And what he does is he undercuts all that and gives up his power. Gives up his power all the way to a cross. And he says that that's what we're to do too. Now, I don't know how you reconcile those two things, but there are quite a few Christian myths out there. David's myth here is empire building. He's seen the folly of Saul. He's married to Saul's daughter. He's a man of war at this point. He's not the innocent boy, shepherd boy, who was chosen because he was innocent. He's far from innocent at this point. And I was talking to a friend this week, and we were talking about how God acquiesces to our lunacy. How he actually gives in. When we demand a king, he says, boy, you're going to get burned. I told you I don't want you to do that. Okay, here you go. And he keeps doing that, knowing full well what the result is going to be. Because I think we just won't believe it. So as David is promising God a grand house, position and power in the world, by his sword, God goes on to make some covenants with him. Talks about his offspring and his lineage. Talks about how he's always going to have a throne and all those things. And part of the myth appears in our psalm that Patrice read for us. And there's really great things there. There's really great things. And the lectionary writers, I'm not sure where they're going or where they want us to go this week with a choice of these scriptures, but there are some things that are denied. There are sections in the gospel text where Jesus goes through some gyrations. It's all that stuff about crossing over to Gennesaret and the obstacles from the weather and all that. They're going to Gentile land. All that stuff is skipped over. And here in the psalm, it stops short. It has all these glowing things about punishing people who would come against David. About God being on his side. And if you read the rest of the psalm, it kind of turns on a dime. It ends up here with, I will not violate my covenant or alter the word that went forth from my lips. Once and for all, I have sworn by my holiness. That's strong words. I will not lie to David. His line shall continue forever, and his throne endure before me like the sun. It shall be established forever, like the moon, an enduring witness in the skies. It's good stuff, isn't it? But also remember that this is written in Jewish poetic language. And as we've been discussing myths, if what we do is the way we read these scriptures, is we pour into this things that it doesn't even claim for itself, then we will find ourselves in error, because we can stop there and say, all that is true. And we'll find the fulfillment of this in Jesus. Rightly so. But it goes on. But now you have rejected him and cast him off. You are angry with your anointed king. You have renounced your covenant with him. And it goes on and on with some terrible things. Please read the whole psalm. And what we have here is we have the psalmist who knows the promises, who knows the things that David wants to be a big shot for God, that David has this nation and he's trying to make it big and strong, and he thinks that the way that you go about creating a kingdom for God on earth is to go beat people up. He thinks that the way that you reveal God is to be stronger than everybody else in the ways that they're strong. Except, if they're a bully, you have to be more of a bully. And what the Psalms are the Psalms are this gut-wrenching crying out, pleading at the beginning of this, reminding God of all these good things that you need to do for our nation. After all, you're with David. You would never leave him. You want his throne to exist from generation to generation without end. Remember that, God? Remember? Remember? But you rejected him. And you turned away from him. What's that about, God? And from their gut, they're crying out, why are we in this mess? Why aren't you around anymore? Why have you rejected us? Don't you see? We're a laughingstock. The king who brought Israel and Judah back together. The king, the guy who's anointed, the one that you would never turn your back on. You've turned your back on him. You see, what we have is the beauty of this being preserved for us. This building project that God, in building a house for him, he never meant it to be building a house that's bigger than all the other gods. He already had that. If they would have remained on God's trajectory, if they would have remained being the people of peace, if they would have stopped making enemies wherever they go, if they would continue to have been nomadic people, if they would have remained on God's trajectory. The good news is that they're allowed to be honest in front of God. Maybe honest isn't the word. They are certainly revisionists in their thinking and in their writing. But they are allowed to be steadfastly hurt. Steadfastly angry. And God has big enough shoulders that he can withstand the, yeah, but you said, God, what about that? You promised us all. And God says to David, he says, that he's going to remain faithful. So what does he do? Jesus comes along and salvages David's bankrupt kingdom, morally bankrupt, religiously bankrupt, ethically bankrupt. Jesus comes and establishes that. In so many ways, we can't even name them all here. Maybe it's a good thing to talk about in house church. Because he comes along and he shows them the right path, the right trajectory. He does what they refuse to do. He's in the lineage of David. He sits on David's throne. His throne lasts forever, literally. He does the very things that David would not be. He goes to the foreigner. He goes to Gennesaret. And all those people touch him. And they're healed. Now, I've been talking this week about the big picture again, the meta-narrative. A friend of mine from high school was visiting us a couple days. And I'm not sure that I can see the story if I dig around in the minutiae. If what I do is I try to use the Old Testament to proof text what Jesus is doing, and that somehow it was sort of a hiccup in time, and somehow the prophet, you know, who's speaking to, you know, that Samuel is speaking to David and promising Jesus in the future, I'm sure that in God's sovereignty and his omniscience, I'm sure that he knew Jesus, you know, I'm sure he saw the end from the beginning and all that, but I don't think that's what's going on here. What I think what's going on here is that Israel screwed it up. What I think what's going on here is that the idea has always been the trajectory of forgiveness. The big picture, the meta-narrative, if what we want to know, are we talking about everybody being the same? We all need to sing the same songs like in the film. We all have to have the same culture. We all have to be carbon copies of each other. Is that really the point? And somehow if we aren't, somehow we're distanced from God? Or is the point, is Israel's point, that they were to show a type of gospel kingdom? One where God really is the king, not an earthly one. Really, a kingdom where they have farm tools instead of weapons of war. What if that was what they were supposed to have been? What if these psalms wouldn't have had to have been written in this way if they would have kept on that path, and even if they would screw up from time to time, to at least know that that's who God is and that's who they follow? What if the idea of Jesus healing was not self-promotion, but was, this is what you guys should have been doing all along. A sign that that sin is forgiven. That God does not hold anyone in contempt. That he's already forgiven. That the idea of Jesus coming and ministering to Israel, because that's what he said, was to show them vividly their own story played out correctly. So you get to go to Gennesaret. You get to go to the Gentiles, the ones who aren't like us, the ones who aren't even ruled by our God, just to show them how much I love them. See, the big picture, whether it's healing or crossing boundaries, it's to make people welcome. It's to, the good news is to let them know that God has already forgiven them. See, Jesus' ministry was to Israel, to show them the right way, but also to not allow them to make sacrifice anymore. See, them doing sacrifice, if done correctly, would have shown the world something. But instead, in their arrogance, the same act is teaching the world something entirely different. Telling them that they have to come and do that too. Telling them that they won't be accepted by God unless you become exactly like us. Unless we can proselytize you and drag you into our community, you are not accepted by God. Because you can't do these sacrifices. You see, there's a totally different message there. The same act, two different messages, two different dances from last week. And the whole idea was to show the world that God holds nothing against them or over their head. To win the world over with love. Well, part of that ministry to Israel was to dismantle the temple system. Because today, they cannot play that hierarchical game. They cannot play the game of God likes us better, and you see why? Because we can sacrifice and we can atone for our own sins. And you can't unless you join us. You see? And so Jesus comes and he dismantles the temple system so that they can't make atonement anymore. Just like who? The Gentiles. As Jesus goes around being Israel, modeling Israel from the Exodus to the final sacrifice where you can't do it anymore. You cannot keep alienating people. And he shows them the whole while, this is how you cross boundaries. This is the type of house I want built. Not one made out of cedar. One that stretches to all corners. See, this, our lectionary reading for tonight can be all about how the promise was given to David and Jesus fulfilled the promise and that his seat and his throne is everlasting, and look at the magic in that and look at how that happened. And that might be true, but the larger context, the parts that are left out are the parts just about how he would not allow a caste system to develop and marginalize people except a select few. So when you have indigenous people living in on this continent, and the myth is that we're persecuted somewhere else and we come here and we'll be a blessing to them, and if they don't like how much of a blessing we are, we'll kill them. And then showing them love is going to them and forcing them to deny their heritage and their home rather than showing them who God is by how much they love them. Do you see? We're doing it again. and indigenous people in the United States have every right to sing angry songs. They have every right to talk about how wounded they are. And we should be ashamed of ourselves if we aren't the balm of healing, because that is who God is. What I love about the Psalms is that they're honest in the way that they don't hold anything back. And that ought to be a clue to us that God doesn't hate the psalmist. God loves the fact that you're not ashamed. That you can say stupid things to him. That you can even accuse him in your own misunderstanding. And he doesn't hold it against you. And somewhere along the line, the psalm will turn around and it'll be, "But you, O Lord." And somewhere there's humility that's found. Because if you hate the world enough, the world will hate you back. And if you love a world that might hate you at first, at least you have peace with God. With that in mind, listen, continuing in Ephesians. "So then remember that the one time you Gentiles by birth called the uncircumcision, they had a name for you. By those who are called the circumcision, the physical circumcision made in the flesh by human hands, remember that you at that time were without Christ because you were aliens from the commonwealth of Israel and strangers to the covenants of promise." You see, they kept that from us. "Having no hope and without God in the world. But now, in Christ Jesus, you who once were far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ, which ended sacrifice. For he is our peace. In his flesh, he has made both groups into one and has broken down the dividing wall, that is, the hostility that was between us. He has abolished the law and its commandments and ordinances, that he might create in himself one new humanity in place of the two, thus making peace, and might reconcile both groups to God in one body through the cross, thus putting to death the hostility through it." Is this making sense now? Without the arrogance of "we're right because of our temple system." The system that David had to build to be big. "So he came and proclaimed peace to you who were far off, and peace to those who were near. For through him, both of us have access in one spirit to the Father. So then, you are no longer strangers and aliens, but you are citizens with the saints and also members of the household of God, built upon the foundation of the apostles and prophets, with Christ Jesus himself as the cornerstone. In him, the whole structure is joined together and grows into a holy temple." See, people, not cedar. in whom you were also built together spiritually into a dwelling place for God. See, walls will keep people out, and walls will keep people in. And God's looking for a hospice. He's looking for a hotel. He's looking for an adopted family. He's looking for walls that are welcoming. Because inside those walls is the hearth of the house. That's where there's warmth. That's where the fire is. That's where the food is. And so while David and his misunderstanding, and the psalmist crying out and pleading in his misunderstanding, are all really wanting peace. But there's two different schools in how to do that. There's two different kinds of walls. See, God will be traveling around in a tent, homeless. And you can put him inside a beautiful home with vaulted ceilings, and he's really not at home until he ends up residing in everybody. And it's really just a tiny little house unless everybody is invited to be a brick in that house. And so this homeless God who roams around the earth wanting so bad to not have his house on fire and warring with each other is really prescribing and rescuing even David. And showing them why their way won't work unless it's founded on love and peace. Because God needs a home. You need to make some honest assessments within yourself. What kind of walls do you have? Because you got them. Are they inviting walls? Are they walls that ooze unselfishness or hoarding? And if you endeavor to be God's house, what would it take for us to be as honest, maybe, as the Psalms? Cry out to him in our misunderstanding and allow him, in that guttural language, to bring us low and make us humble so that maybe we're willing.
You have been listening to Beside Stillwater's netcast. For more information about Stillwater's and its ministries, please visit besidestillwaters.net.